D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Mit Sibylle Salewski. Wenn Sie den amerikanischen Wirtschaftswissenschaftler und Nobelpreisträger George Akerlof suchen, dann könnten Sie ihn vielleicht auf dem Jahrmarkt finden. Stundenlang hat Akerlof Kindern beim Karussellfahren zugesehen und dabei die Grundlage für seine Identity Economics entdeckt. Szenen wie die folgende haben Akerlofs Überlegungen in Gang gesetzt. Während sich das Karussell im Kreis dreht, winkt ein vierjähriger Junge auf einem Holzpferd strahlend und stolz seinen Eltern. Sein zwölfjähriger Bruder hingegen rutscht missmutig auf dem Frosch hin und her. Es ist ihm peinlich, Karussell zu fahren, denn er weiß, dass er eigentlich schon zu alt dafür ist. Zumindest sagt das die gesellschaftliche Norm. Die beiden Kinder auf dem Karussell haben ganz genaue Vorstellungen davon, wie sie sich verhalten sollten. Und diese Vorstellungen hängen davon ab, wer sie zu sein glauben. Sie hängen von ihrer Identität ab. Genau so verhalten wir Erwachsene uns in wirtschaftlichen Kontexten, argumentiert Akerlof in seinem Vortrag hier bei uns auf D-Radio Wissen. Wer wir zu sein glauben, bestimmt, wie stark wir uns für unsere Firma einsetzen oder wie motiviert wir unseren Aufgaben nachgehen. Akerlof hat seinen Vortrag am 26. August vergangenen Jahres gehalten, beim vierten Treffen der Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger in Lindau am Bodensee.
This talk is based on the book Identity Economics that I've just completed with Rachel Cranton, and that gives a picture of what the title page looks like. So, in the spring of 1996, Rachel wrote me a letter, and she said that the paper I'd just written, which was called Social Distance, had missed the concept of identity. She said that that paper classified social motivation as peer effects, which is what you usually find in the labor economics literature now. With peer effects, people change to conform to what other people are doing. But Rachel said that peer effects are the wrong way to represent social motivation. And the thing, as it turned out, after we explored it for some considerable time, is that Rachel was actually deeply right. Initially, I had thought that Rachel was in error. I had thought that identity was, in fact, just an aspect of people's taste. And as a result, I also thought that standard economic theory already took full account of it. But then we mulled it over for many months, and we discovered that identity really does, it really does have a meaning. And it's well defined in the context of economic modeling. So, in my 30 minutes, I think the most important thing for me to do here is to motivate you, to indicate to you that there's something there. There's something that this is just, as I've said earlier, the tip of an iceberg. So identity is second nature. It's second nature for many social scientists, but economists were systematically trained not to see it. The standard view of economics is that it's about incentives. To give you one example, that's the main theoretical theme of the very good book Economics. By training its sights on price incentives, standard economics is price theory. But then that takes us to the central question here. Are there types of motivation? Are there types of motivation that are not described in current price theory or that are missing from current economics? And we think that identity is one of them. So we ask the question whether there's a systematic way to think about and to characterize this motivation. Our goal is to analyze it by tools that are very similar to those of standard price theory. But motivations regarding identity are all but absent. They're all but absent in current price theory and in current economics. Yet, as we're going to see, identity has serious impact on many of the most important economic problems. So standard method in economics is based on the maximization of objective functions. So typically, consumers maximize utility functions, and firms maximize profit function. And this may be a good way of doing economics. The description of what people are maximizing gives a formal way to classify how firms and how consumers both behave. So what it does that by classifying their motivations. That's how we use these profit functions and utility functions. I now want to give you some motivation for why identity does matter, for why this is important motivation. But economists' characterization of people's motivations misses important aspects of that. People typically have opinions as to how they should or how they should not behave. They also have views on how others should or should not behave. Their views about how they and others should behave depend upon who people think they are. Sociologists would say that it depends upon their identity. What does that mean in economics speak? That means that they lose utility insofar as they or others fail to live up to those beliefs regarding what people should or should not do. So such motivations are central. They're central to motivation in modern sociology, but they're absent from economists' representation of utility. People's views of how they and others should or should not behave are called norms. So these views, and furthermore, these views are held often with very great conviction. But I should say that they're not always ethical views. In fact, very often they're not ethical views. We somehow hold these views subconsciously. For example, I feel I should probably not give this lecture while wearing shorts. Maybe I said, probably okay, but I have that view, and I sort of hold it, maybe strongly. Okay, so now we're going to talk about something that makes this very operational. You can actually put this into a model very easily. So sociology is a further concept. It is a further concept that gives an easy and natural way to add those norms to the utility function. Sociology say that people have an ideal. They have an ideal for how they should or should not behave. Furthermore, they often conceptualize that ideal in terms of people. So it may be someone they know, it may be someone they do not know, or it may even be an imaginary person. We can then bring this into standard economics by a simple device. We just modify utility functions that express people's motivations. We modify the utility functions to add a loss in utility, to add a loss in utility that depends upon the distance in behavior from that ideal. So let me give you an example. So this is, a very strong example. So religion affords many examples of norms that are described by the behavior of an ideal person who is typically the founder or the prophet of the respective religion. So for an example, let's consider Christianity. So consider Christianity's use of the Gospels. The Gospels describe the life of Christ, and this is what Christians believe. Christians believe that a Christian ought to take the Gospel of Christ as the model of behavior. A Christian thinks she should be ashamed insofar as she does not live up to her interpretation of the Gospels. But religion is only one of the many realms. This is just one of many, many, many realms where people have such an ideal. So to appreciate the ubiquity of norms and motivation, it's useful to see some further examples. Now, what are those examples going to demonstrate? They're going to demonstrate that people tend to be happy when they live up to how they think they should be, and they're correspondingly unhappy when they fail to live up to those norms. And I think, I know that's how I behave. I know that this is a major part of my motivation. I think when you think about yourself and you think about something that you're doing and you think you're doing it well, according to how you think it should be done, then you tend to be happy. And then when you think you're not doing it well, it tends to make you unhappy. And so this is really motivation that's very important, and that's what this is about. Okay. So now I'm going to give you some examples to try to motivate you. So here's an example that comes from my life and quite possibly from yours. Teacher usually has a clear view of what it means to be a good teacher. So I know when I teach a good class, I feel good about myself. And when I teach a bad class, one that doesn't seem to go over, I feel really quite bad about myself, and it takes me some time to recover. So Think about the same, you have the same feelings apply to almost any activity that you do, from playing golf to playing tennis to being a good parent to whatever else it is. It applies to the conduct of most jobs. So Randy Hodson, who's a sociologist at Ohio State University, surveyed ethnographies of the United States workplace. And this is what he found. He found that most employees care about their dignity at work. So what does that mean? They want to conceive of what they do as useful, and then they feel a lack of dignity if they are thwarted. So those who are unable to get such satisfaction are likely to show their displeasure by acting up in some way or other. Okay, so now I'm going to give you another example. So Irving Goffman has found an example of a natural experiment that's revealing of adherence to norms. So he observed the behavior of children of different ages when they were brought to the local merry-go-round. Now, because appropriate activity differs by age, the children should have predictably different reactions. So for the toddlers, riding a wooden horse is an accomplishment. They're tremendously pleased by this. So I've got a toddler there, and he's tremendous. You don't have his top of his head, but he's tremendously pleased by what he's able to do. Father, he looks a little bit worried, I guess. Actually, if you ever go to the merry-go-round, you should go and observe this. It's actually quite interesting. I did that. So in contrast, for older children, there's a gap between their conception of how they should behave and riding the merry-go-round. So the older children need to distance themselves from an activity that's so age inappropriate. So they do so by riding a frog rather than a serious animal like a horse, or they show up by standing up dangerously during the ride, or in some way or other, they just can't be there. They're not supposed to be there. They like that merry-go-round going around, but they somehow can't do it. So actually, I went to my local park with the merry-go-round in Berkeley, and I saw exactly what it described. The 3 and 4-year-olds all were doing exactly what that guy was doing. Well, not quite what they were waving merrily to the parents on the sidelines as they passed by. But then I got a glimpse of what this is all about. I saw a 13-year-old. I don't think I was just lucky. I think if you go to the merry-go-round and you watch it for, let's say, an hour, you'll probably find this. I saw a 13-year-old who went onto the merry-go-round, and this is what he did. He first warily sat on an ostrich. He later switched to a horse, and then he went to another animal. And finally, remarkably, while the merry-go-round was still turning, he seems to have gotten off. As I see, he was simply in hiding, and I lost sight of him. And he simply got off and went off in the background. Now, you find the same thing, you talk about the merry-go-round and the kids and everything. But you'll find the same thing in surgical operations. So in surgical operations at medical schools, because of their inexperience, the medical students are given tasks that are, you'll be happy to know, ridiculously easy. But they respond in the same way as the older children at the merry-go-round. They just can't stand being there. They are not living up to who they ought to be. These people are already doctors by the time they're holding that clasp there, which is not going to kill you. But so what they have to do is they play the clown. And Goffman has quotes from them, too. So these examples are then illustrative. They're illustrative of behavior that is pervasive. And sociology is then dense. It's then dense in examples of people's views as to how they and others should behave. And this is what people do, and I think you do too. They show their joy when they live up to those standards, and they show their discomfort and reactions when they fail to do so. Okay, so that describes some of the motivation. Now, it turns out that you can simply add this motivation simply to almost any economics problem where it should happen to be appropriate, and it turns out that it's pretty easy to do so. So how does this apply to economics? The typical demand curve, as you all know, is said to be derived as people choose the best combination at each price and each level of income of the apples and bananas that they're going to buy. That's the typical textbook demand curve. So we economists, we're very clever. We're very clever in altering the utility function to take into account many social considerations. And there's lots of literature on this, which I'm sure a lot of you know. But we've not altered it in a way that takes into account identity. So what does that entail? What that entails is for people to have a view as to who they are, like the examples of the Christians, or the teacher, or the children at the merry-go-round, and corresponding to who they are, they have an ideal for behavior. And then they lose utility insofar as they do not live up to that ideal. They may also have an ideal for how others should behave. And then we lose utility insofar as those others do not behave that way. And then people often seek to restore their identity. And that's especially interesting because many of those reactions, such as dueling and making foreign wars, they are very perverse. So it's useful to make a habit of adding the considerations that I just described to people's utility functions. And it's easy and it's straightforward. So there's an easy, simple three-step procedure for adding identity to standard economics. So what's that procedure? So that procedure goes as follows. In any situation, characterize how the decision maker conceives of herself. Sociologists would say that this is her identity, or also this is her social category. They have a fancy name for it. And if you read the sociology books, unless you understand this, you know, you just say, gee, they're talking a lot of nonsense. Okay, that's one. Two, corresponding to this identity, ask what is her ideal for how she should behave. So we have notation for that. We call that ideal E star. E star depends upon how she conceives of herself. It depends upon her social category. This ideal, to remind me, you, is E star, which depends upon C. It depends upon her social category of C. Now, we use the letter E because in many of these problems, ideal effort is a key variable. So that's why we use E. Okay, so that's the second part of the procedure. We ask, what is our ideal for how she thinks she should behave? We then go to the third part of the procedure. We then ask how unhappy she will be, insofar as her actual behavior, which we denote as E, departs from this ideal, and then we add this to the utility function. So what have we done? She has the standard economic utility. We have no objection to that. We believe that's very important in many problems, and maybe even dominant, and that depends upon the standard economic variables. And she also has an additional argument to her utility function, which depends upon the distance between her ideal behavior and her actual behavior. So it depends upon the distance between this abstract thing we call E star and her actual behavior, which we call E. So knowing this will give you a prediction how she will behave. Okay? So there's an innovation here. So this is central to economics, to sociology, but we do not see it in economics. Innovation here, which every sociology takes as second nature, is that the utility function's not fixed. The ideal, which is E star, depends on the person's social category. That's the moving part here that makes this theory different from standard economics. And then, of course, there's an easy and important extension. In addition, according to procedure, in many problems, people not only care that they are living up to their own identity, but their identity is affected by other people's actions. And then they may be motivated to act on this in turn. For many problems, this should also be entered into the utility function. Now, I think you're going to be surprised at how important concerns about identity are for your own happiness, and also for most of the decisions that you make. And it turns out that this method of analysis explains a great deal of people's motivations, and it explains it naturally. This is just the way you yourself, if you hadn't been super trained in economics, would have actually described how people are behaving. And it's the stuff that People magazine is made of. And it explains the motives of everyone, from school children to the most ruthless dictators. Okay. So now the question is, this is either good or bad, depending upon whether it works. So the proof of the pudding, I guess we all say, is in the eating. The question is, can we use this to describe economic phenomena with which we are all interested and which are all of some importance. So we have six of these, six applications, and we have six applications of minority poverty, economics of organizations, education, gender in the workplace, gender in the household, and macroeconomics. And I'll briefly describe how these come about, very briefly, and I think maybe you can figure out, fill in some of the missing blanks. So minority poverty. According to plain vanilla economics, minority poverty exists. It exists because minorities have few resources, and also they suffer from discrimination. Okay? But the standard sociological view adds something important to this. It adds the concept of oppositional culture. In this view, minorities that have experienced severe discrimination in the past have a hard time accepting the culture of the group that has treated them so badly. In our modeling, they can choose to be insiders and accept the dominant culture and to suffer, but then they suffer the psychological consequences of not being allowed to pass. Or they have the alternative is they can become outsiders. They can become outsiders who reject the dominant culture, but that has severe economic and also social costs. Their identity choice is then to be either insiders or to be outsiders, and corresponding to the different identities are going to be different ideals. Insiders have ideals which say they should cooperate with the dominant culture, and outsiders have ideals which say they should not cooperate with the dominant culture. And then why does poverty develop in this model? Poverty then develops from choosing to be outsiders. So that's minority poverty. So now I'm going to give you economics of organizations. Standard economics says that the motivation of employees in organizations mainly concerns their monetary incentive structure. We agree with that, that this is important. But our models say, additionally, that employees may identify either as insiders or as outsiders. As insiders, they will have ideals that accord with the goals of the organization or with the goals of their jobs within the organization. In that case, they will need little inducement to perform well. As outsiders, their ideals will be contrary to the goals of the organization, and in that case, they will need additional incentives to perform well. Making people insiders reduces the incentives that are needed to get employees to perform well. It thereby solves the problem. It solves the problem of purely economic incentives. Now, a great deal of the economics of organization concerns how, with purely economic incentives and goals, workers are going to game the system. My reading and other people's readings of the economics of organizations is that organizations simply don't work with economic incentives because those incentives tend to be so big and so large in order to get people to do what they have to do, that, in fact, the people are going to game it and the system doesn't work. I think that is what I would say would be the dominant theme. But then what solves that problem? What solves that problem in organizations that tend to work is that the people know what they should do. They identify with their jobs for the most part, and then they go and do them. So the monetary incentives are important. They're not unimportant. But these other incentives, the cement of what causes the cooperation and brings the organizations together. Okay. The economics of education. Similar analysis applies to schools. So education that gets students to adopt academic ideals. So we can apply the same sort of model of insider-outsider analysis. Such choice of identity of who students want to be plays a central role. It plays a central role in the three major questions in the economics of education. I'm going to go through them one by one. So first, what is the demand for education? The demand for education describes how long students stay in school. So, for example, the plain vanilla economics of education says that students drop out of school when the rate of return from an extra year of schooling has fallen to the rate of interest. That's the standard theory. So an identity approach says, though, that the major reason that students drop out of school is that they no longer identify with being there. So if you think you should go just to finish high school, and you don't think you should go to college, then you drop out after you're finished in the United States your 12 years of grammar school plus high school. That is what determines when you drop out. So it shifts in the utility from being in school as students advance in education, then, is what causes the rate of return to fall to the rate of interest. And the key role that's being played here is not the rate of interest. It's really what the key role that's being played here is that people at some point think they should be in school, and then beyond that, they think they shouldn't. The second and third questions in the economics of education are what makes school works and what is the role of adolescent society in the educational system. In identity economics, this is largely determined by students' choice of identity and then their consequence ideals for how they should behave. Now we go to the economics of gender in the workplace. So gender discrimination in the workplace. The plain vanilla economics of gender says that men do not want to associate with women in the workplace. That was the old gender economics. Identity economics says the following. Identity economics says that most gender discrimination occurs because tasks are disparately but inappropriately described as male tasks or as female tasks. The standard economics says the competitive markets will erode such distinctions. Identity economics, on the contrary, says that it takes a political or social movement, such as the women's movement, to erode them. Economics of the household. The plain vanilla economics of the household has many different models of the division of work between husbands and wives. What does identity economic models? Identity economic models say that such divisions, even today, are largely determined, again, by norms. In this case, norms regarding what tasks should be done by men and what tasks should be done by women are, even today, what mainly describes how household tasks are divided between men and women. So they're men's tasks and women's tasks, and women tend to do the women's tasks, and men tend to do the men's tasks. Okay, macroeconomics. Standard macroeconomics, based on economic maximization, has many different neutrality results. We all know all of these neutrality results. Let me give you two leading examples. First, in the plain vanilla model with rational expectations, monetary policy has no expected effect on equilibrium income. Second, in the plain vanilla model, there's no such thing as involuntary unemployment, since wages will be bid up to, or bid down to, the point where the supply of labor is equal to the demand for it. Anyone who wants a job, then, at such wages, will get one. Now, identity economics solves these problems because there are norms regarding the level of wages. So the wages may be above market clearing. In fact, they will tend very often, especially in times of insufficient demand, to be above market clearing. And then there is involuntary unemployment. And there's involuntary unemployment in this case because they're rationing. And that gives us a very, very different model than how many people are describing the current crisis. And then talking about the effect of monetary policy, at least in normal times, identity economics also tells us why, in fact, monetary policy will easily have an effect on the level of income. Why? Because the norms may impart nominal stickiness in wages and prices, so that, for example, a 5% increase in the money supply will not just be accompanied by a 5% increases in prices and wages with no effect in relative prices or wages. So that's why this identity economics is very helpful even in looking at issues as big as macroeconomics and answering some of the puzzles that have been given us over the last 30 or 40 years as to why the old macroeconomics that people had in the 1960s, why that was not working. So this is the book, and thank you very much. Thank you for listening to me.
Das war der amerikanische Wirtschaftswissenschaftler George Akerlof. Wie wir ökonomisch handeln, hängt von unserer sozialen Identität ab, sagt Akerlof. Er hat seinen Vortrag im August vergangenen Jahres gehalten, beim 4. Treffen der Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger in Lindau am Bodensee. Der Vortrag basiert auf Akerlofs Buch Identity Economics, warum wir ganz anders ticken, als die meisten Ökonomen denken, das er zusammen mit der Wirtschaftswissenschaftlerin Rachel Cranton geschrieben hat.
D-Radio Wissen. D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.